Hello, everybody. This is the Gingerbread Man, and I would like to welcome you to my home. Thank you for being here. Appreciate you showing up. Let's get on into it. Sorry for not being here last week, but I have a very important reason. My son had a tremendous birthday this week. He is now an 8-year-old, which is a very big man. I did a birthday party for him last Sunday, and stressful little me had a lot of things going on, a lot of pieces to move, and I had a lot of organizations to organize, and just I got really overwhelmed, but it worked out really well, and I think he had a good day, and I got him a lot of shit, so success. But I'm back this week, and just wanted to check in with you guys and see how you're doing. Have you done any like life essays lately? Like, look at your life. Just sit down, slow down a little bit, take a couple deep breaths. The breath is a very powerful tool. Some say it was the first mantra. A mantra is something repetitive, and it can come from a lot of different cultural backgrounds. But the breath is an easy one. The body keeps us alive with the breath. And it's a non-voluntary action that we don't have to think about too much. But we can. We can voluntarily do it. And we do. Something happens where we, at least I, feel calmer. The in and the out breath were once thought to be the name of God in the ancient Israeli texts in Hebrew. There is no vowels or consonants in a name that cannot be spoken, or a concept that cannot be thought. But we all have access to this breath, always, anytime. I want you to remember that you have this tool at your disposal. Just take a couple deep breaths over the next couple seconds. How do you feel? I hope you feel a little bit more centered. I'm standing in my closet on a Sunday morning. I've woken just not a long time ago. There's a thin layer of snow outside, but it's late April, fully born into spring, and my expectations for summer are fully germinated. Yet there's still snow. And when I was younger, I used to love these days because it gave me an excuse not to have to go outside. And I felt less guilty about consuming television and other things because obviously it was harder to go enjoy the weather outside, right? But nowadays, you know, I kind of get sad. I'm not like heartbroken by the weather. It's part of reality. It is what it is. I'm okay with where it is, you know, but I definitely have a part of me that definitely enjoys the sun now, and that part is sad. And it got me thinking about the ebbs and flows and the Tao of life. We're not always given a consistent stretch of anything, and weather is a great metaphor for internal capabilities and our own self-image. My own self-image can change a lot. I was reading this really interesting book of Buddhism by the dude Lama Surya Das, who I described in previous episodes. He's a Western Lama, but he was talking about how the goal with an enlightenment process is part of it is contingent with becoming stable. And a person at the whims of reality looks like a leaf floating on the wind. You know, this way and that, and hectically to and fro until you can't see the leaf anymore. Or the bag, or the piece of paper, or the tumbleweed. You know? But the point is that none of these objects are taking any sort of self-control into their own hands. They're just at the mercy of life. And I think part of that within the internal image is an essence of pity that we begin to feel for ourselves and for our station or our expectation again. Like, I have a lot of expectations for my boy, and I love him deeply. That's why I work so hard for his birthday. That's why I work so hard every day to supply a home and food. And I'm working to try to be emotionally better so I can help support and supply his emotionality as well. But because of my lack of stability in the world sometimes, certain actions or inactions may or may not come into place in a happening. No, I haven't talked about that one in a while. But a lot of things happen, and I love that word, and I call it the happening, because happenings are always happening. It doesn't imply that they have any reality to them, that they're anything less than what we can visually see on the surface in the world of appearance. And what I mean by a lack of reality isn't that it's not real. It's just that it lacks a depth. So maybe I'm not saying it's not real. It's lacking a depthality. And like, we always have these loaded contexts that we apply onto all these situations in life. And it's the ego's job, because the ego crunches numbers and measures and makes thoughts. And it's like this spawning machine that's incessantly producing these things, these thoughts. And then we're affected by these thoughts. We help curb the thoughts. We help fertilize what thoughts we want to see more, you know. But at the end of the day, we end up overcomplicating a lot of things, and we start adding depth onto situations that are non-existent. And this is where paranoia can come from, and all kinds of other different neuroses that people can be burdened by. I know I am. So the situation with my kid, you know, he's 8, or he's just now newly 8. He was just 7. He doesn't have enough computational adept ability yet. So he fucks up, and then I have an incredibly negative emotional response. There's a lot of loaded context to the situation. You know, I have, you know, my work, my job, security, blah, 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 all the things. And this is just a metaphor for any fuck up, you know, like it could be anything. You know, I'm not trying to say that this is the situation, you know, but when I approach a situation, I have this emotional backload that's attached to all these thought trains that have helped make a facsimile of the situation. Whereas when I just look at the surface of the situation and use Occam's razor and cut it all away, then I actually have the situation of what is. And all my extra bullshit is superfluous. So I hope you're following. So in the metaphor of the leaf or the bag or the paper, what's drifting in the wind as it goes, you know, the wind is the whimsy of the ego and all the different thought forms and ideas that we make and use to help craft our world. It's pretty amazing, right? I think it is. But as in the last episode or two episodes back, sometimes we make mistakes, and it's part of life. So I want to be able to read situations better without becoming neurotic about it. I want to be able to live presently, fully, in a moment, in a day, in an hour, in a minute, in a here, in a now, without being burdened by excessive thought form. I don't want to make myself sick with it. Like, you can't tell, I obviously had a negative reaction to my boy this week. And it's pretty severe when it comes to childcare and when you have dependence on such a little human, which shouldn't be the case, but as a single parent and all the other single parents out there, you know, when we don't have a lot of capital in the parenting game, you just gotta clutch at straws sometimes, make it work, but not make it worse either. That's what I'm trying to figure out how to do. So I sit and I breathe. And I'll sit on my floor. And I'll try to dig through all the murky, foggy clouds that cover up the center of my soul, myself. At the central spark and the invulnerable apex, the piece of me that is pure, it becomes shrouded. Sometimes I know you feel disconnected from yourself. And part of this disconnection or disassociation with our own being gets replicated in the world. And then all of a sudden, instead of feeling at one with the world, you may feel it too. Like, sometimes when I find myself and I put myself into the separatism, you know, I'll begin to find that pity kernel that we talked about earlier. And then I'll start to grow from my pity seeds, anger storms, where I'm angry at the world. And I become angry at the impulse, and I become angry at even the being itself that is just simply perceiving it. Does that sound similar to anyone out there? I don't think I'm the only one, by a long shot. I'm sorry this episode's so murky and dark, but this is what we're talking about, you know? Like, not everything is cherries and rainbows. Not everything is birthday parties. Everything is complex and is imbued with negativity and positivity, a contraction and an expansion, an up and a down, a cooling and a warming. You know, the Hindu karma or the Taoic way. And so through that lens, I don't even feel that it's negative. But we have to look at our pieces to know who we are. But again, the breath is neutral. The breath is primal. Primary. It goes back to the beginning. It's a lead back to that kernel of selfdom. When we become lost and confused and mired in our own complexity, it's an easy trail of breadcrumbs to find our way back. So I sit and I breathe. Huh. So, been reading a lot of good stuff this last couple weeks. I'm reading a book by Ramana Maharshi, which was a prominent guru in India in the early 1900s. It was referenced a lot by people like Ram Dass and Raghu Marcus and that whole group of goons. It's a simple philosophy. And he was self-taught. And even though he was deeply religious and imbued in his cultural package, He's very, what's the word? Approachable, I would say. And within the simplicity of his thought, I find a lot of associations or connections with others. And that's what I always do. I read from a lot of different directions. You know, I read from Western philosophy and Eastern philosophy. And then I read from scientific, empirical backgrounds, and I read from religious, theistic ideology, and I read fiction, and I read parenting books, and I read all kinds of different things. And on the surface, most of them don't seem to have any connections, but for me, when I hop from one book to the next, it's like they're all holding hands. And I see so much application even between an old book of religion from 1500 years ago and a Western philosopher philosophizing about the meaning of life. You know, everything's connected in some way. And that's the principle of omnism. You know, we're all climbing up the mountain, but when we get to the top, we're all going to see the same thing. So everything connects, and that's just what my brain does. Maybe it's my brain doing it, and maybe the books aren't holding hands. But either way, it's one of my favorite things to do, is to make all these connections. So Ramana, he speaks about this concept of I am, and how through asking questions and through analysis of this essence, this soul searching, you know, we are to destroy, and he uses a very like intense verbiage, like we're destroying the ego, you know, which is not exactly what I'm trying to do. I want to work with my ego, and I want to train it, and I want to get a good clicker and teach it how to eat treats, you know, but I'm not exactly trying to kill it. But Ramana was, and in order to get closer to God and to be within self fully, one has to completely bend one's ego. And so through questioning, one can reach this I am-ness. And so every time a thought comes up, even in life or meditation, we're asked, who is this thought directed to? And when you ask yourself that, the attention gets directed towards awareness, which sometimes can be like this mirror in a mirror, like a mirror corridor, which can be almost impossible to distinguish, but it helps us get closer to feeling the idea of awareness. And so every thought you ask, who is this directed to? Oh, it's directed to I, you know, that essential essence of awareness that's up there. It reminds me of the teachings of Nisargadatta Gita. I think that's the book. Dude's name Nisargadatta, but he had an I am ideology too. I'm pretty sure he was Indian as well. So a major implement of Eastern thinking is this separation between egoness and selfness, whereas Zen Buddhism would come in and say that there is no separation and your isness is your selfness. And we just complicate things. But here's the interesting connection with what I've been reading. I've also been reading this dude named Sartre, and he's an existentialist, which existentialism is a heavy, heavyweight philosophy. And I can't even come close to depicting it because I barely understand what I'm reading. But basically, he's talking about being and becoming. And how we all struggle in our heads because we always have a self-concept of what we're heading towards. The ideal. Or the ideal in the world. And how the world should be. And this is where I kind of got all of my ramble about surface appearances earlier. Because Sartre would say that all you have is what is and what you see. There is no becoming. Like, we never will be that. We always are this. And existence happens in the existent. not in the rationalizations about them or in ideal thought forms. Here, I'm going to go grab a piece of his writing real quick so you can have an example. All right. Here goes. Transition. Becoming. Anything which permits us to say that being is not yet what it will be and that it is already what it is not. All that is forbidden on principle. For being is the being of becoming, and due to this fact, is beyond becoming. It is what it is. That means that by itself, it cannot even be what it is not. For me, this sounds like a Buddhist. At least the way my brain connects it. So, the soul, the essence, that spark, Atman, the I am-ness of Brahmana, that's our being for me. And we can never shake it. And just while I have it in front of me, here's a little quote from Ramana. Why should we, without submitting ourselves to it, constantly worry ourselves with thoughts as to what should be done and how, and what should not be done and how not? We know that the train carries all loads, so after getting on it, why should we carry our small luggage on our head to our discomfort, instead of putting it down in the train and feeling it at ease? That was Ramana Maharshi. And I can't help feeling the connection between these two people. Even though Sartre was from the 1800s and lived in France, and Ramana was from the early 1900s and lived in India. Culturally, quite divergent, yet for me, I see such a similarity. So, I want to leave you with one last metaphorical idea. When it comes to surface appearances, I'd like you to consider that it might have some connections to music. When we beat a drum, we have the layer, which can be assembled in any size for different pitches, different tones. But you need some sort of skin, something taut to form tension. And then you have it on a casing, and then you hit it with a stick. When you hit the drum, the sound waves exist, but they reverberate through the ether that was already there, and then you perceive the sound. Is the sound actually in the drum? Or is it the motion and the action of the moment where the hitting happened, where the surface friction and the stick and the skin meet? That momentary, impermanent happening created the sound. And the sound is ethereal in the fact that it is impermanent as the action itself that created it. Okay, have I lost you? Any sound, any musical instrument, even though it is performed through the instrument, the sound itself exists separate from it. Right? So consider that this world of forms, this world of Maya, illusion, that we are all in. And not to say it's like a simulation, but the metaphor of the Matrix helps. What if the world is just like those sound waves? And you have this appearance of action and karmic responsibility happening all the time. You have all kinds of drum beats and all kinds of things. But you can't hold onto the musical note. You can't grasp it. And that's the nature of our world. A human life is like a shooting star or a cloud that dissipates. And the mechanism of the world is akin to a drum or to our body or to our physical machinations and constructions. But life and consciousness is like a sound wave. And the harder you hold it, the quicker it drips through your fingers. So just some stuff to think about. Thank you so much for listening to my yarn. Especially if you've been here for a couple weeks or even longer time. I want you to know how much I appreciate you. You're very important. Very. You were given this life. And it doesn't mean that a hand gave it to you. But by some chaotic chance, you have it. And as humans, we have so much potential. And within that potential is possible agony, but there's also pleasure, passion. So just don't hold on too tight. And try to love it and love you like I do. Thank you so much for being here. Go Grabo. So Odin's a little temperamental this week, but he'll be back next week. Have a great week, you guys. Take care.